Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:11 p.m. and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes, and it's December 6th. I think this chart of the S&P 500 is something that every long-term investor needs to pay attention to. I think when we micromanage and tend to pay such a great deal of attention to the news headlines, to the fact that the world has been taken over by tweets, 140 characters seems to be now the thing that everyone pays attention to. But it clouds the fact that we are in a very impressive bull market. That bull market has been going on now for about a decade, and it has been really reasonably consistent on the upside. And one of the most, I think, important points to highlight is that when you do have a consistent trend, when a consistent trend is a trend in motion, and therefore the pattern should continue to repeat itself. As long as the pattern is repeating itself, well, then we have an imbalance between supply and demand that is being animated by a certain number of factors. We can identify what those factors are after the fact, but it's the consistency of the trend is the evidence that supports the view that there is an imbalance between supply and demand. Then all we have to do is monitor the trend. And when the consistency of that trend changes, well, then we can start to think about, well, there must have been some change to the animating factors that have created the trend in the first place. And I really do think that from a long-term investor's perspective, when one is attempting to play a secular bull market, and secular bull markets on stocks can last for a very long time, then one does have to pay attention to the 1,000-day moving average. And I think it's important to just look at how that has performed historically. So, for example, when we look at the bull market that got going really in the early 1980s, the 1,000-day moving average had already started to offer support back in the late 1970s. And despite the fact that we had an incredibly impressive advance out of the blocks in 1980, going from 100 in 1980 to 300 in 1987. So that was a 200% advance in 7 years and a very wide overextension relative to the trend mean at the time. Even the crash in 1987 found support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. The pace of the advance moderated for a few years subsequently, and yet the 1,000-day moving average offered support then as well. It was in 1995 that the pace of the advance really did start to pick up, and it went for longer and further than anybody really thought possible. And the market then went from 430 up to a peak of nearly 1600. So it went up 4 times in that period of time, despite the fact that it had more than doubled and tripled in the period previous to that. Well, that was the bubble phase, when we had very wide overextensions relative to that long-term moving average, and that it persisted for a long time. Well, it was, I think, rather, then of course we had the incredible performance of the NASDAQ during that time, which was truly spectacular. Now let's just go back and think about what happened in the bull market previous to that. Off the lows in the in 1929, it was really only in the period from approximately 1950 onwards that the 1,000-day moving average started to offer support. We started to see some substantial drawdowns below it from approximately 1965 onwards, and that gave way to a secular period of stagnation. Therefore, when we look at the moving average relative to the trend mean today, well, we can see that there is an overextension. But the question I think people really should be asking is, at what point in the cycle are we in? Are we in the beginning phase, or are we in the middle phase, or are we in the bubble phase? And there is the realistic possibility that we are somewhere equivalent to either 1995 or 1998. One argument that would suggest that we are closer to 1995 is the consistency of the trend. We've just broken out of another two-year range. These two-year ranges, we've had three of them already. Each one of those ranges has seen a consolidation in the region of the peak when it's close to being resolved on the upside, and then a subsequent period of very impressive and consistent trending activity until we get the next substantial pullback and then the beginning of a two-year range. We've just had it again, and we've just had another breakout, and the market is closing out the week well off the lows. We had a two-day pullback on Monday and Tuesday, and over the course of Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, it's pretty much unwound all of it. This has become a very easy market to monitor, because all we need to do is to look at the consistency of the trend. This market has been prone to 18-month consolidations, and when it has eventually broken out, it has consolidated in the region of the peak, and when it has completed that consolidation, it has trended impressively higher from there. Therefore, all we have to do is monitor the trend. Provided the breakout is sustained, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. The surprises should be on the upside. The other important point is something, the way that I tend to think of consistent trends is very similar to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and it is the more information we have about the consistency of the trend, the less likely it is to be repeated. Even though we have a consistent trend as a trend in motion, the more information people have, the greater security they feel in the repeatability of the pattern, the greater the likelihood is that they will attempt to anticipate the action. And when they start to anticipate the action, that's when we start to get a change in the imbalance between supply and demand. It is potentially what contributes to acceleration. And it is the acceleration is a trend ending in itself. That would, to me at least, suggest that we are in more like a 1998 scenario than a 1995 scenario, but that doesn't necessarily mean we have to be in either. It could potentially be that we're just going to see another consistent move on the upside, and then followed by another reversion back to the 1,000-day moving average. Of course, if we get an impressive move on the upside, the overextension relative to the trend mean might be as wide as it was back in 1987, and then we could have the potential for a substantial pullback, and that would probably coincide with a recession. One thing that's important is that the yield curve has inverted. Something that we anticipate is that the yield curve is a lead indicator for future recessions, but it is a very long-term indicator. It was inverted in August, so that started the clock. It could be anything from 1 year, 6 months to a year, to almost 2 years in as a lead indicator before the next recession. The most important urgency appears when that spread starts to accelerate higher. Most particularly when it is accelerating through 50 basis points, that's really when people start to get worried, because it is representative of the Federal Reserve becoming worried, because they are very aggressively cutting interest rates. We are not there yet. If we look at the trajectory right now, it is still a good long way from 50 basis points. There is the potential that it will contract. what I think is also interesting in here is if we look at the muni yield curve, the municipals yield curve, and I think I need to try and remember what it is. I think it's probably much easier if I just simply look at all of my ratios. When we think about the muni yield curve, what I find particularly interesting at the present time is that there are a lot of I think there are a lot of news stories talking about the very large deficits that the states have, and what kind of impact is that going to have on finances, on taxation, for the vast majority of the states that simply have not really considered the potential that they're actually going to have to make good on their promises to their investors. I'm sorry for not being articulate while I've been searching for this yield curve chart. When we look at the yield curve for the municipals, it didn't invert. Some data that I saw reported on at a conference earlier this year was that, generally speaking, one of the confirmatory signals for an inversion of the yield curve is when the corporate curve, the high yield curve, the muni curve, and the treasury curve all become inverted. So while we had a very swift and mild inversion of the yield curve, the muni curve has not yet inverted. I think that there is the potential that we could be in a similar situation to what we saw in 1998, when we did have some easing. It was back here in 1998 that we had some easing. Then the yield curve came all the way back down and became inverted again in 1999, and then became sharply inverted. That, I think, is perhaps the closest analog to what we have now. The other point, of course, is that the interval between when we get the first inversion and when we start to see the reversal occurring generally corresponds with a very impressive move in stock markets. In 1998, the market went up 50% between the first inversion and the stock market peak. Between the inversion in 2005 and the reversal, the market went up 30%. Well, the market is already up impressively off the lows that we saw in the third quarter. And I do think that there is ample scope that we're going to see additional upside in here, regardless of whether this is the beginning of the bubble phase or merely another leg higher in a secular bull market. I think that the balance of probabilities is that the surprises are going to be on the upside. And that's not a consensus figure. In yesterday's comment of the day, I think, in fact, I will simply repost yesterday's comment of the day, simply because a lot of people aren't looking at the website every day, and they may value access to all the reports that I posted yesterday. But the point that I thought was most interesting is the commonality that we're seeing in terms of the commentary coming out from lots of different asset managers and investment banks about what they think is going to be likely for asset classes next year. The most important point is that there's such commonality. They are all looking at how much uncertainty we've had this year and projecting for even more uncertainty next year. But I think that's to ignore the point that what we are already seeing is very clear and substantive action to provide assistance to the markets. The US Federal Reserve has added approximately $300 billion of liquidity in the last 2.5 months. That has unwound a really quite substantial proportion of the previous tightening. The clear message here is that the Federal Reserve is going to do whatever is necessary to try and contain risk in the financial sector. When we then think about the spread that emerged between the new LIBOR rate and the old LIBOR rate, or back in September, that's not supposed to happen. A 300 basis point spread is really rather extraordinary. And that was the motive factor behind the Federal Reserve starting to inject liquidity. Then when we think about the TED spread, the TED spread isn't something that anybody really pays attention to until they have to, which is why I tend to take a look at it at least once a week, because it's not at alarmingly high levels right now, but it is moving higher. And if we were to start to see this spread breaking higher, then what it is representative of is risk in the financial sector. The TED spread is the difference between LIBOR and 3-month yields, 3-month LIBOR and 3-month yields. And LIBOR rates have been pushing higher. So that, I think, is something that tells us what we are being presented with is an environment where banks are not quite comfortable with lending to one another. It's not an alarming rate, and LIBOR rates have been coming down this year in line with interest rates. They're just not coming down as quickly as at the federal funds rate or the yield on the 10-year treasury is. Well, there are a number of different reasons for that. When we then think about the banking sector, if we're starting to see very early evidence of liquidity tightness, that's not being reflected in the banking sector's charts. The S&P 500 Banks Index is in the process of breaking on the upside. It has clearly broken the downward bias over almost 2 years. I think it is important to look at this index over more than just the last decade, because it is within striking distance of taking out the peak put in immediately before the financial crisis. And that is something that nobody was willing to predict back in 2009. Of course, what it is also a great example of is the changes in leadership that occur following a crash, because the biggest banks today are not the biggest banks from yesteryear. JP Morgan has broken on the upside and continued to do phenomenally well. It was the early leader off the lows in 2009. Citigroup is still substantially below the peak that it put in ahead of the financial crisis, although I do think that the only way to really look at it on a long-term basis now is with a logarithmic scale chart, just to put into perspective the recovery rather than the decline. 10 years on from the decline, I think it is time to think about what they're going to do next rather than what they've done before. At least there is a sequence of higher reaction lows within this emerging slow-paced advance. Then when we think about where are the problems in the banking sector, well, the European Banks Index is back above its trend mean, and it was well off its lows in here this week. So what we are starting to see is that the banking sector has been out on the periphery, where nobody has really wanted to really think about it for really quite a prolonged period of time. And yet we're starting to see that even the most sold-off banks are starting to steady. The fact that both Japanese and European banks have bounced and are back above their respective trend means that they are steadying here in the region of previous lows is positive. It is suggesting that some of the factors that were contributing to their decline have moderated. One thing that is also, I think, rather important is that both these markets have been in prolonged periods of consolidation. The Nikkei, for example, has been ranging below 20,000 since 1992. That feels like a long time, and it spent the last 2 years ranging above it. This is a first step above the base. It suggests that Japan is back in a new bull market, and that in the course of a new bull market, that it is not overly optimistic that it could take out the peak put in 1989, which would take it almost to a double from where it is today. And that's not a consensus forecast, but when we look at the price action, then that is being supported. That view is being supported by the price action. This is still a really quite consistent advance. The hallmark of the bear market had been every time the index got up to 20,000, it failed and made a new low. And it stopped doing that in 2016. So that was the change. And of course, the big change in Japanese policy has been the currency. It was in 2016 that we saw the second big push to devalue the currency. Now, we haven't had another move like that since. And over the course of the last 3 years, there has been an upward bias to trading for the yen. And it was a little bit steadier in here today. What that suggests is we are going to have to see some additional action to weaken the currency in order to really see this index starting to push back up on the upside. Then when we look at what's going on in Europe and simply look at it over the long term, then 400 has been an area of resistance for the last 4.5 years, and now it is right on the cusp of breaking on the upside. The upper side of, or at least the point at which the index has encountered resistance, both in 2000 and in 2007, is within striking distance. It's only about another 10% on from, 15% on from where we are right now. And that is not an overly ambitious target for some point next year. When we look at the Europe Stocks Index, which includes Japan and, Switzerland, the UK, and Sweden and Denmark, it's on the cusp of breaking on the upside. This index has been ranging below 400 since 2000, and it looks a lot better supported now than it ever did on each of the previous occasions it got back to test that level. So we have the real potential that what we're looking at today is scope for catch-up, that Japan and Europe have been sitting out the performance on Wall Street. They are trading at a valuation discount, but the country that's trading at the biggest valuation discount today is the UK. The FTSE 100 has been ranging above 7,000 for the last 3 years. We're coming increasingly close to a point where a favorable answer to the Brexit saga is going to be delivered. If the UK leaves with an agreement on continuing to pay into the EU's coffers and continuing to abide by the customs union until they have a trade agreement agreed. Whether the exact timing for that is going to be by the end of 2020 or not is rather beside the point. If the UK can finally get away from the EU with the least possible disruption to its economy, that's a best case scenario. There is the real potential that That best case scenario is achievable. And that suggests that the valuation discount that has emerged because of the big depreciation of the pound from 2016 onwards can get closed. What we've definitely seen in here this week is that people are starting to look at the currency more favorably. The pound has broken above the 130 level for the first time in about 8 months. More importantly, it has found support in the region of the trend mean. The most important thing it can do now is continue to hold this breakout. 140 is probably going to be an area of resistance. There is the simple fact that there is no country in the world today wants a strong currency. So the UK is going to want to continue to have a reasonably weak currency in all likelihood because they want to support their economy just like everybody else. But the more important consideration is that if 140 is the peak, then 120 is probably the low, and we're unlikely to see the 120 area penetrated. The only time that the 120 area was penetrated was all the way back in 1985, and then it didn't last very long, and it subsequently just about doubled in the course of the next 6 years. There are certainly base formation characteristics for the pound against the dollar, but they're even more graphically illustrated by the pop on the upside we've seen over the course of the last 7 weeks against the euro. The euro has got much clearer base formation characteristics, but the pound has got a very large overbought condition as it approaches the psychological 120 area, so it would not be at all surprising that we see at least some consolidation in the region of the 120 area. When we look at what is going on in terms of the UK assets, I thought the news stories coming out over the last couple of days about M&G having to shutter a property fund, then that is obviously problematic because of the investors who have been putting money in there. One of the most important points that has been emerging over the course of this year is the problem nature of low interest rates. Extraordinarily low interest rates have benefited bond portfolios by delivering momentum. We have basically substituted yield for price momentum. And that works fine in the short term. But when the vast majority of pension funds attempt to have at least a partial ladder in maturities, it means that they take the biggest benefit from the holdings they've held for the longest time. And whenever yields start to pop on the upside, they tend to take a loss on them if they've been buying them recently. Well, there was an awful lot of bonds that were trading with negative yields as recently as August. The total got to 17 trillion. It's at about 11.5 right now. So now the question is, are we going to see it continue to contract? Are we going to see the total quantity of bonds coming back below 10 trillion? What I think is rather possible is that that's a likely outcome. If we're going to continue to see recovery in the Japanese and European markets, then it is likely that we're going to see yields pushing back on the upside. Of course, the one thing that people were completely betting on when we had this profound move in yields was that we were never going to see inflation again, and that there was going to be perpetual demand for bonds. Well, the Bund yield got down to a low of a negative 80 basis points. The entire German yield curve was at a negative yield. Since then, the yield has popped back up to minus 28 basis points, but it is now approaching the region of the trend mean. There is scope for it to continue to move higher. When we then think about Japanese yields, well, they are still negative, but they were at a negative of 30 basis points in August. They're at almost zero today. There is the potential that at least the 10-year is going to go back above the zero bound. One thing that was completely discounted was there was going to be no inflation. But that is, I think, a rather dangerous conclusion. The one thing that we do tend to see in the latter stages of major bull markets is an inflation scare. Quite whether it eventually translates into a new cycle of inflationary pressures, or whether it is short-term in nature, is rather beside the point. If we do see an inflation scare, it is generally representative of a surge in commodity prices, the outperformance of cyclicals, and that is generally supportive of very late cycle activity. It's at that point when we have already seen a very significant move in commodities, then we need to pay attention to the potential that we're going to see a peak in markets. And it's at that point that we need to be particularly alert to the consistency of trends. We're still very early in any potential inflationary outcome. The continuous commodity index has just broken its downtrend. It is, it has been consolidating above the 400 level now for about 6 weeks. That's the minimum requirement to suggest that we're back in a bull market environment for commodities. Now, the industrial resources are still really quite depressed. What's particularly interesting is if we contrast the continuous commodity index, which is unweighted, with the CRB index, which is heavily weighted by oil, then that is also starting to just about break its downtrend. But when we then think about the raw industrials sector, then we are presented with a very different trend, and it has been deteriorating all year. Well, this spot raw industrials index has a lot more in common with the LME metals index than the continuous commodity index. What these are telling us is that the slowdown that we've had in industrial production, whether that is as a result of the trade war or the slowdown in China, the slowdown in Germany, and recession threats that have been felt right across Latin America, the reality is that industrial metals are not rallying. What this also tells us is that if the continuous commodity index is turning, one is that it is being driven higher by other commodities other than the industrial resources, but also if industrial resources start to turn around, then it is going to add further fuel to inflationary pressures. And with copper starting to do better, there is the potential that that is going to start to fall into place. Copper prices were up in a dynamic manner in here today, up 8.65 cents. The more important point is that it is back above the trend mean, and it's doing so in a dynamic manner. Upside follow-through next week would start to lend credence to the view that we have seen a low of near-term significance. Now, when, for example, we look at tin, tin prices have been pulling back rather sharply over the course of the last few months, but we're starting to see some evidence of support coming through with that big upward dynamic we saw about 3 months ago. Aluminium prices have also been under pressure. This is also a big internationally traded commodity, and it is still in a downtrend. When we then think about what's going on in terms of the Baltic Dry Index. It has been extraordinarily volatile, but it is looking increasingly likely that this break up above the $1,500 level is going to hold, and that what we're seeing now is the beginning of a first step above the base. Now, we had a pop on the upside like this in 2013, and subsequently shipping rates came all the way back down and in fact made a new low. There is obviously a risk that that could happen again on this occasion, that the breakout will not hold. Therefore, it does need to be monitored. But one thing that we can conclude is that if the chart we have right now is of tanker rates, of the dirty tanker rate for oil, in this occasion, we do have better evidence that there was a bigger pop on the upside this year, and better evidence of support being found around that psychological 1,000 level. And this move has been substantially larger than the one that we saw in 2013. We do have the IMO 2020 rules coming in about 4 weeks. And that is going to be disruptive for the shipping industry globally. There have certainly been efforts underway to install scrubbers on the emissions for a number of ships, but sometimes the value of the scrubber exceeds that of the ship, and that obviously contributes to scrappage. Well, if you're scrapping ships and not replacing them, then that reduces supply. If we see a catalyst emerging over the next 2 weeks, with December 15th being an obvious catalyst date, where the USA has said that they are going to impose additional tariffs if there isn't a deal agreed to on that date, well, that obviously is something that negotiators are going to want to avoid. There is, I think, the unlikely scenario that additional tariffs are going to be imposed, particularly if the USA and China can say that they're both negotiating in good faith. But if we do see some of the tariffs being removed from China, then that is going to start to support the global growth view. It will probably act as a catalyst for additional demand for industrial resources, and particularly additional demand for oil. Oil prices now are right in the region of this $65 area. They have been unable to support a move above $65 for the last 6 months. And this is also the region of the trend mean. There's been a lot of column inches spent on the question of whether shale supply is going to continue to increase next year. The most important point about trying to increase and having visibility on increases in spending to create additional supply of oil is going to be on the commodities curve. When we look at the fact that the vast majority of oil is of the oil produced from onshore unconventional sources in the USA is profitable around $55. They don't have a great deal of incentive to hedge that exposure in anything other than approximately out to a year from now. What obviously they would like to do is to be able to hedge their exposure out to about 3 or 4 years at a price of $65. If they could hedge their 3 or 4 year exposure at a price of $65, then you would see a great deal of capital flowing into the unconventional oil sector. There would be a massive uptick in drilling, and there would be a huge quantity of supply that was completely immune to the ensuing decline in prices. We are just not there yet. We're either going to have to see the price move higher from here In other words, the longer end of the curve is going to have to move higher. If the backwardation persists, it means the entire curve would have to shift higher. On the other hand, we would alternatively have to see prices come way back down, have a lot of supply taken out of the market, and cause a short, sharp rally higher. One way or the other, we're not going to see a big move in additional new supply from unconventional sources until they can hedge that exposure and reduce their financial risk to drilling. Then we have the fact that Saudi Arabia has just IPO'd Saudi Aramco. It's been an almost entirely domestic affair. They've raised about $25 billion from the IPO. They've attained a valuation of $1.7 trillion for the company by selling about 5% of it. Well, what they are now intent on doing is ensuring that all those investors, particularly the domestic investors that bought into the IPO, are going to be rewarded. So they announced a somewhat larger contraction in supply. So what we're in fact seeing is OPEC is moving to contract supply, and because of where the price structure is, the major unconventional suppliers in North America are unlikely to be spending a great deal of money. At the same time, Brazil and Norway are rather active in trying to bring additional new supply to the market. So there is a balanced environment, but the backwardation tells us that very short term there is a dearth of oil. If we do see a positive response from commodities to a trade hiatus or a deal, then oil could potentially rally on the upside. I do think that what we are, however, looking at is a long-term range, because there is lots of additional supply of oil around $80 a barrel. There is the additional point that we are looking at an increasingly large number of electric vehicles on the road. What I find particularly interesting is the number of Teslas on the road around where I live. They have gone from being a rare occurrence a year ago to being a very common occurrence over the course of the last 3 months with the arrival of the Model 3. I'm continuing to see a lot of commentary about queues at the superchargers that Tesla provides. One thing that is important, I think, is the demands that an electric car puts on a household. There is obviously a value proposition in terms of the savings on fuel, but you also have to consider that it costs $1,000 to install a charger in one's home. And that is something that that deters some people from participating. And of course, there are others who do not have the facilities in their homes to install chargers, particularly those living in apartment blocks. That's an inhibiting factor until we see that there is going to be a much more robust charging network. But one doesn't necessarily have to occur without the other. There is the clear incentive for additional charging infrastructure when the number of electric vehicles increases. We're rapidly getting to a point where the value proposition for owning an electric vehicle is becoming incontrovertible. The improvements in battery technology alone are something that are going to have a profound effect once they become more, imbued in the public knowledge of the sector. The fact that there are Model 3 cars on the road today that have driven 1 million miles on the same battery without losing more than 1% of charging capacity basically completely negates the concern that people had had about wasting money on a battery that only lasted for about a year or two. A car that can drive 1 million miles is something that people can start to amortize over the course of many years. And obviously people want to have a new car, they want to have new accessories, they want to keep up with technology, and that creates demand for new vehicles, but it also creates a great second-hand market for electric vehicles if they can hold their value. And of course, that is before we ever get to autonomous vehicles. If a car can drive 1,000,000 miles, then an autonomous vehicle can be driving all day if they can persist for that long. Even for the rental car industry, it makes a great value proposition. Then there is the real potential that if energy prices go higher, the value proposition for an electric vehicle become even more compelling. Then there are the potential outcomes that future batteries are going to have longer range. The new Tesla pickup truck, the more expensive version, has a range of 500 miles. Range of 500 miles is getting up there with diesel cars. I remember my Audi A4, when I lived in Ireland, was a diesel vehicle, and it would easily go 600 miles on a tank. And of course, that was driving outside of the town, but on longer term trips. Well, an electric vehicle that goes 500 miles is about as much as anybody would want to travel before taking a rest. So that is going to completely get rid of range anxiety. The vision of what we're going to see in future is, I think, quite profound. And there are going to be casualties. One thing that was, I think, clear in terms of the retail apocalypse was that there were conventional large retail chains that have been completely inept in terms of delivering on their response to the onslaught from the e-commerce sector. I think Macy's is one of those. It is now trying to convert itself into a REIT rather than focusing on its retail arm. When we then think about the outlook for the automotive sector, well, there are going to be casualties in terms of the ability to continue to perform. The fact that we have had this process of mergers, certainly between Fiat, Chrysler, Nissan, and Peugeot, well, these are all middle-of-the-road brands that are at acute risk from the onslaught of electric vehicles. The fact that it's about now battery manufacturing capacity rather than the internal combustion engine also means that the number of parts that are required is considerably less. The service industries that have evolved are considerably less. Well, that is one of the factors that weighed on the German stock market. But the benefit that we have in terms of stock markets is that once the bigger companies become smaller companies, then others take their place. And Germany continues to do well in terms of its stock market. The bigger question is, when are we going to see fiscal stimulus coming through in Europe? I personally think that it is inevitable we're going to see it eventually, because if we don't see it soon, then there are going to be continued populist successes in elections, and it will eventually manifest itself in government policy. There's already some discussion of it in their kerfuffle between the SPD and the CDU in terms of their coalition to support Angela Merkel's government. Then when we think about what is the where are the opportunities? Well, certainly, if we are seeing a return to performance of cyclicals that is beneficial to commodities, then we have the return to performance of the biotech sector. biotechnology is another highly disruptive influence because of the real potential for cures rather than treatments to be the solution that we're having to what is an intractable problem. When we look at the trajectory of national spending on healthcare, whether it is the ridiculous sums that are spent on healthcare in the USA because of inefficiency and avarice by the various components of this sector, or whether it is the necessity to spend increasingly large quantities of government revenue on expenditures for nationalized health, particularly in Europe, the intractable fact is that the number of elderly people is going to increase over the course of the next 20 to 30 years. It's probably going to contract subsequently, but there is just no way that the ability of governments to fund all of that healthcare is going to be possible without very significant tax hikes. The only possible way we're going to get around this problem is with a technological answer, and that means drastically cutting the cost of care. Alzheimer's, for example, represents approximately 10% of all healthcare costs. Then we have diabetes, and then there are the there's cancer care, which is a massive, it's almost $700 billion a year globally in terms of the cost of care. When we think about arthritis, it's something that there is no known cure for. There is no known cure for Alzheimer's. There is no cure for diabetes other than discipline, which is incredibly difficult. What we need is cures, and it is cures are what the biotechnology sector are providing. There is the really quite considerable potential that we are going to get out of the proof of concept phase at some point over the next 3 or 4 years, and it's at that point that we're going to see a massive change in the healthcare sector. When we look at the cyclicality that we have in the biotech sector and compare that to the rhythmic or more rhythmic trend we have in healthcare, the defining characteristic of that rhythmic move we've had in healthcare is cash flows. It's the reliability of cash flows from chronic conditions that is really contributing to the consistency of these trends. It is basically an iteration of the subscription business model. It's just that a patient with a chronic condition is a reliable source of cash flows. That could certainly come under pressure with the inventions of new treatments, particularly on the genetic front from the biotechnology sector. What the response of the healthcare sector to that onslaught is twofold. They're certainly not standing still. So they are buying out those companies so they can either control the release of the technology or they can gain the expertise themselves. But one thing that we are definitely seeing is a much more intent emphasis on psychiatric drugs because a lot of psychiatric illnesses are not genetic in nature. They're much more about lifestyle. It's much more difficult to pinpoint the genetic key to a psychiatric disability. So there is a lot more money moving into psychiatric solutions because they do generally tend to have a longer tail in terms of the continued demand for the product once someone has been prescribed it. That is perhaps going to be the saving grace of the pharmaceuticals sector, What it also suggests is that the continued emphasis on mental health is going to get a substantial boost from the healthcare sector, because they have a very clear financial interest in ensuring that everybody has an awareness of their mental health and is prescribed accordingly. There is obviously a push and pull to that particular argument. Then when we think about it, technology is really the answer to a lot of humanity's ills. It's also responsible for a number of our ills. It's likely to continue to be a deflationary condition. There is also the real potential that the advances that we're getting in technology today, whether that is quantum computing or the real potential that quantum computing, artificial intelligence, and the innovations we're seeing in superconductors and magnets is going to create fusion energy. There is the real potential that we're going to see more hydrogen become a very significant factor in the global economy. One thing we know is that major bull markets in the energy sector tend to contribute to secular stagnation in stock markets. Big ranges in energy tend to contribute to secular bull markets in stock markets. And then I think it's also worth considering gold, because gold prices have popped on the upside. We have seen a base formation completed, and there is the real potential that all we're seeing right now is a consolidation. The one condition that we have today is that we have extraordinary monetary stimulus and we have extraordinary fiscal stimulus in a simultaneous manner, and that is eventually going to contribute to devaluation of currencies. We are potentially at the point where we're starting to see that with the dollar today. But despite the fact that there is scope here for additional asset price inflation, that asset price inflation may come as a side effect of the devaluation of fiat currencies. And it's against that background that gold is the real barometer, because gold might only have just broken out against the US dollar, but it's at a new high against the Australian dollar, it's at a new high against the Brazilian real, and it's at a new high against the Canadian dollar. When we think about it versus the Chinese renminbi, it's not quite at a new high, but it's really not all that far from it either. Against the euro, it's consolidating in the region of the prior peak. Against the pound, it broke out to new highs and appears to be consolidating at present. But when we look at other currencies, then there is clear evidence of continued strength in the gold price. And these are, I think, important points, because it is when gold is appreciating in most currencies that it tends to do best. We're also seeing that governments are hedging their bets and increasing their gold holdings. That's a very different condition from what we had over parts of this last decade, and certainly before the big bull market started going in the year 2000 or 2001. I think there is the real potential that gold is going to continue to do better, and that the next time we have a recession is when it will really start to attract a great deal of interest. What that suggests to me is that it is a buy on the dips, and personally that's what I will be doing on my personal trading, is attempting to buy on the dips. I think there is obvious clear potential for stock markets to do better from here. I think there is clear potential that we're going to get a number of technological solutions that are going to completely change the global economy over the course of the next decade. The invention of quantum computings alone, or quantum computing alone, is a phenomenon similar to the invention of the microchip. And I don't think it's possible to completely appreciate just how profound that change is going to be. That is alone something that could contribute to a secular bull market. What that suggests is we're going to get productivity growth, but we're also going to get to a point where the promises that have been made to pensioners are going to have to be addressed. And the most likely scenario for that is to devalue the currency. And gold is potentially going to do as well, or close to as well, as stocks in that kind of environment. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.